Welcome to my first podcast of 2024. And there's nobody I'd rather be sitting with than both a dear friend, broadcaster, presenter, author, Bethany Hughes.
Hello.
How lovely to be here. What a beautiful place to be at the beginning of the new year.
It's fresh start, fresh hope. But of course, funnily enough, it was also almost at the beginning. I met you at the beginning of my Downton Abbey story, Highclere's Downton Abbey story. And my Downton Abbey story as an author, and as my life took different paths and journeys, I suppose. And Highclere certainly became one of the most famous homes in the world. Isn't that extraordinary?
It is extraordinary. And I remember it. When was it? What year did we meet?
Well, I think it must have been 2011.
Right, my gosh. So what? So we've passed our decade. We've had 10 years of friendship. But you're right. So it was when I was doing that sort of history and country heritage show, Countrywise, wasn't it? And we came and filmed here. I remember being a bit nervous as I was coming to a big house, and we hadn't met, and were we going to get it right? And we just got on. We just ended up talking about history all afternoon. That's what I remember.
I can't remember. I just think of you, smiles and laughter. And Rachel Detaine was here, who was great. It was such a joy to meet her as well. And going through the Wild Flower Med, and there was Paul Heine and Mike. Oh, golly, I know Mike's face and his first name, but not his surname.
No, I always called him Mike the Hunter.
Mike Roberts, Mike.
Yes, well, remember. I think Very good.
So, and right. He was doing the food section and preparing, I think, maybe some lamb, I can't quite remember. Yeah. There were four parts to the hour show for Countrywise for Peter Fincham, CEO of ITV in those days.
So. Yes, that's it.
And then after that, I got my first commission for a book. You were already established as a presenter and well-known historian on TV, Bethany. And I learned a lot from working with you just that first time. And I keep learning so much from you and how you are in front of the camera whenever I have the joy of meeting you, actually.
Oh, you're so lovely. That's a lovely thing to hear. Well, absolutely, you know, feelings mutual, because this, so that's what I remember is us just, we've talked about history a lot and the role of history and the value of history and the importance of places like Highclere, where we're sitting now, of just carrying shared memory from all kinds of people from all kinds of times, and how when we write about history or talk about it, we're surrounded by these living characters from the past. You know, it's not, people have said this to me before, isn't history the story of sort of dead people and, you know, times gone past? It's not. It's about lives and hopes and fears, which are often very similar to ours. But I do remember us in that beautiful top room looking out at the lawn, and as I said, us just getting on. And then we came back and did another one, a special about this place during World War One, at the time of the centenary. So
we did two centenaries here at Highclere, one in 2014, which I think is the one you're referencing, and then I did another weekend in 2018, the centenary of the end of the First World War, raising money for those who serve and those who save. They were extraordinary endeavours. It's just our little team here who do it. So it is exhausting and challenging, and yet I'm so glad we've done them, and we've brought thousands of people together. And I think at the second one I had 30 different ambassadors from so many different countries, all standing together, thinking of those who had died and saying thank you and how we could perhaps live a little bit better.
Yes.
And there was singing and music and dancing and talks, and Hugh Bonneville, Lord Grantham, interviewed Lord Carnarvon.
Yeah.
And I interviewed Julian Fellowes.
Yes.
And the Indian High Commissioner gave the most amazing speech. The million men who fought and died for a king and another country. So many extraordinary strands pulled together and people pulled together. So I loved that.
Yes. That's the thing. Those are the positives that come out of those sad stories, aren't they? Exactly that. That actually, because people often say to me, oh, you know, isn't the history of humanity the history of war and strife? And it's not, because
we wouldn't be sitting here today if that was the case. If all we wanted to do was to exterminate one another and cause pain, we would not have survived. There, more often than not, we try to find solutions. We try to find peace. We try to find ways to have conversations and to keep relationships going across borders and boundaries. And, you know, there's a beautiful thing, as you know, the classical world is so important to me. And there's an incredible moment in Homer when Homer's writing, you know, his incredible epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey, and a diplomatic truce has been agreed. And then it's just one hot-headed archer who fires off an arrow, and the fighting starts again, and hundreds, thousands of men die on the battlefield. And basically, Homer, or whoever it was who set that down, who told these beautiful stories, was reminding all of us, it's down to each and every one of us. You know, we all have agency. We can actually, by the things that we do, by what we say, by how we act, by how we think, we can affect world events. You know, you sometimes feel powerless, but actually we can, you know, because it's all about individuals doing the right thing. So anyway, so I agree. So when you have those moments when those extraordinary statesmen and women come together, it's a hopeful thing, because there are moments of peace and love in the world. And let's hope 2024 becomes one which is saturated with peace and love rather than the opposite.
And we're always trying to put the past behind us and try to do a little bit better. Yes. And every day is another day. And it might have been in the programme when you were here, or perhaps another programme. I was talking to Eddie Hughes, our keeper, who'd worked here for 60 years and then he retired. He still lives here with us. And I'd asked him, standing in Lime Avenue, which season was his favourite season. And he turned to me and said, "Milady, every season's my favourite season. Every day is my favourite new day." And I think that's a pretty good way to begin and carry on.
Completely, totally, totally.
And he's also stepping in the footsteps of his predecessors and the keepers who've worked here before. So we're all building on previous people who've planted trees and tried to facilitate conversations around a table with food and wine and things like that. I think food and eating is the heart of families, culture, and it should be the heart of business as well. It matters so much, bringing together. So to sit and eat together.
Yeah, definitely. So I've got something exciting to tell you that, so I've just been out in the deserts. I've got to be slightly mystical about where I am. We're going to announce it soon. So I've been out in very remote deserts looking at this incredible new archaeology from around 2000 years ago, where the people who traded incense and gold, so literally like the Three Kings, gold, frankincense, yes, and myrrh. So those traders who travelled across the empty quarter places that are like now Oman and Saudi Arabia and Jordan. And we're realising that they had these dining rooms, these triclinia, good Latin word, like three couched dining rooms, which were places that they would sit and they would break bread together and they'd share food and they'd share wine. We know that they drank quite a lot of wine then. And it was almost like a ritual of hospitality and friendship. So it was cementing those incredible relationships they were having across thousands of miles by sitting down and sharing a meal together in a really ritualized way. So it absolutely matters, as you said, just that sort of simple thing of breaking bread and sharing. And just what you were talking about, that thing of waking up and loving every day. I mean, the most inspiring thinkers from across history, from 2,500 years ago, if you think of people like Socrates and Buddha and Confucius, Socrates from Greece, he says, "Love is the one thing that I understand." And Buddha said, "Love without limit." And, you know, you cannot argue with that. There is always more time for love. And the more that you love, the lovelier the world around you becomes. So we do have to remember those things and act on them.
I'm now going to quote Paracelsus to you, being a German philosopher. Yeah. To Precy, his German, rather badly in English, it's all about to know is to love, to understand is to love. Yeah. And the more you love, the more is life worth.
Yes.
And it's understanding that the strawberry doesn't ripen at the same time as the grape.
Yes.
It's beautiful. Very beautiful. Lovely few lines.
Really beautiful. So it's sort of taking the time to care to be interested and to care, and then if you care, you understand. That's it's so true. My
gosh. Starts in German. It's quite good. It says "Wer versteht nicht, liebt nicht," and it's the German language can be beautifully concise sometimes.
Yeah.
In a way that my wibbly wobbly language is not always as precise.
No.
But yes, it's quite fun.
My gosh, are we going to keep up these reds? Oh
no,
are we
going to
be full of
now.
Life and love? No. And, you know, for the rest of the year.
But you very kindly brought along with you a book that I can't wait to read, which is coming out in the new year, being The Seven Wonders of the World.
Yeah.
Which are from mythology, from legend. They inspire our imagination. We wonder if they're real or not real, but the first one with which you start is still very real, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so the Great Pyramid of Giza, you know, one of the most famous monuments from not just the ancient world, but of the world, which we've both spent time at, not together, sadly, yet. But
yet.
Maybe we'll,
exactly.
Maybe we'll remedy that. But yeah, this extraordinary thing made of 2.3 million limestone blocks, you know, it was the tallest structure on Earth for thousands of years. And it was the oldest of the seven wonders of the ancient world, and it's the one that still survives most intact, which is incredible. I mean, and that is, you know, I know that you spent a lot of time there. You cannot not be struck by awe and wonder when you look at it, because it's just, it almost makes me speechless. It's so precise. It's something like 2 centimetres out. You know, it's almost mathematically perfect, which is why some people, I have to say, I don't agree with them, say, oh, you know, it was built by aliens. It couldn't have been built by humans. It's so stupid. We're very clever. When we put our minds to it, we're very clever. And it was this sort of giant resurrection machine, basically, for the king, King Khufu. Because you're not supposed to call them pharaohs until about 1,000 years later. So at this point, they were kings. And it's where he was buried. And the people of Egypt thought it was going to help carry him ascend to heaven. Incredible.
But I love all the language which goes from their world and their culture, their imagination, into our imagination and our world. Yeah. And he's again ascending up the blocks of the limestone would have once been covered in smooth limestone, which looked like marble.
Yeah.
So it would have been this extraordinary, reflective, monumental monument. And through that, he would have ascended into heaven.
Yes.
Because this is the world of transience and sand, and that is the world of eternity. So it's the same words that we use in the Nicene Creed today.
Yes.
Which I love. And yet over time, obviously, it's become slightly changed because the limestone's no longer there and you have to slowly step your way to heaven were you to climb up to the top.
Yes.
Which I don't think anyone can do today.
No, people have all tried it. They're brilliant. I have to say, researching this book, oh my goodness, I've come across such fantastic images. So great images from the sort of 1930s of people having climbed to the top of the pyramid and basically sitting there and having a kind of society picnic, you know, in their knitted swimming costumes. But then also there's from a German explorer in 1610, there are these little pen and ink drawings of like basically sort of stick figures climbing up the pyramid and standing at the top and kind of going, woo, you know, when they're up there. So it's obviously something that people, it's a challenge, isn't it, to climb to the top of that thing. And people have always done it. But and I know that you and I both as well done this bonkers thing of crawling underneath it. You've gone down there, haven't you?
I have done that bonkers thing. I don't particularly like small spaces, but I thought I have to do it.
Yeah.
And it was quite warm. And and you also do have to crouch for some of it. So
you
it's
do.
Not for the faint-hearted
no.
or the unbendy people. And it's better not to be too tall, which would suit you and I.
Yeah, no, God. Exactly. Hands and knees at one point in the sand. I mean, I'm the same. I get claustrophobic. It's so stupid. So I'm a historian of the ancient world, so I spend a lot of my time in small, dark spaces. The only thing in life I'm scared of are small dark spaces. So it's a bit ridiculous. But when I'm filming, at least, I have my lovely cameraman, who's my kind of best friend, in front of me going, it's okay, I'm here. You know, you're not alone. But as you know, if you go down underneath the pyramid, you go into the bedrock itself, underneath those limestone blocks, and then into this kind of mysterious chamber. And I remember the first time I did it being so struck. I mean, I don't know if you remember, you can see like the yes. chisel marks on the ceiling. But if you touch the walls and lick your fingers, you can just taste the salts because it was all sea at one point. Mm. So it's that incredible thing of thinking those ancient Egyptians
looked at this bedrock, looked at this incredible plateau, and thought, this is something that is special and magical, and we can make it even more extraordinary by building the most extraordinary structure that Earth has ever seen, or that humankind has ever seen.
It is, and they also knew and understood that this particular plateau was the only one which could bear the weight yes. of the pyramid, which is still the, I think, the heaviest building in the world.
That's right.
And the Sphinx is the largest monumental stone carving yes. in the world.
Yes.
So for all we've done, for our funny little mobile phones and for our gadgets which allow us to build skyscrapers, we've done nothing to equal any of the seven wonders of the world.
Yeah, I agree. You know, they haven't. What are we building now that's going to last for 4,500 years? Not much, I don't think.
No, I think people will probably be more wondering at the Temple of Artemis, which I think is one of your favourites.
It is. Oh, yeah, so you're right. So there are, as you say, there are seven of them. So the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, the pyramid is the oldest, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, and then the next oldest is the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus in what is now Turkey, on the western coast of Turkey. And I just adore it because it's almost the least famous of all of them. But it was huge, this monumental temple, which became the sort of blueprint for all Greek temples that we've ever seen. So the Parthenon was a copy of it. The Temple of Zeus in Olympia was a copy of it. And it honoured this incredible, feisty goddess, Artemis. And again, we might think of Artemis, who becomes Diana in the Roman world, as this slightly sort of wafty hunter, you know, in a little tunic and kind of looking very pretty. Oh, my goodness, the Eastern Artemis was like very much stronger than that. So she's this incredible creature who's represented at Ephesus with on her chest. She looks like she's got kind of 100 breasts, or they might be bull's testicles, or they might be honey sacks. I mean, she's this sort of fecund, amazing, ferocious creature. And she looked after nature and young girls, you know, because it was quite perilous being a young girl in the ancient world. But Artemis was their protector. And she also protected the balance of nature. And, you know, we have to love that, don't we? And we have to love the fact that the ancients wanted to honour a goddess who they thought looked after nature and prevented mankind destroying it, basically. It is probably my favourite place. And it's beautiful. Everybody should go to Ephesus. It's such an incredible site as well. Very beautiful. Incredible remains, all sorts of interesting things like gladiators' graves that line the routes there. So it's a really special, lovely, lovely place.
How extraordinary. So after that, what's the next wonder of the world that you talk about in your book, which I think, I love books like your books because I can, it's not too thick, this particular one. So you can hold it to read in bed at night.
Yes.
You can hold it in the bath, which is my favourite place. It's an honour. I hope you don't mind me saying that, but I love reading in the bath. And then the chapters are not too long either, which I think really helps. And I follow some of your principles when I write as well. So you can read a chapter and fall asleep.
Yes.
So you've got past Artemis, and then where's your next chapter going?
So then the next chapter is the statue of Zeus in Olympia. So this was this incredible thing called a Chrys Elephantine statue, a statue made of ivory and gold. And it was a huge...
Made of ivory and gold.
Hippopotamus ivory and gold. And decorated with glass lilies. I mean, it would have been extraordinary.
And how big would it have been?
I mean, huge, about 48 feet. I mean, so really, really tall. And reflected so that there was a kind of pool of oil underneath it. So it was like, became like double height. So it looked like he was reflected.
Wow.
And if you can imagine this creature sitting, Zeus, the most powerful of all the gods, and what power that would have contained, because the idea that, just think about what would happen
if
he stood up.
So he was sitting on a
throne.
Because so many of the Egyptian statues are seated in the same posture and probably of the same height.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Exactly. So I'm sure there were those references as well. And of course, he was looking
at... It's in front of the pylons, because pylon is a Greek word, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Which we now apply to Egypt.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Exactly, like a kind of gateway kind of thing. Exactly right. And he was there staring out at the Olympic Stadium. You know, this is the
the year of the Olympics again. So he would have been watching all those athletes, you know, run around. Agon is the Greek word. It means agony or kind of competition, sort of sweating and some of them dying, you know, to prove what great athletes they were. So that's the next one, the statue of Zeus, very sort of muscular, macho statue. And then the one after that, which I love, is the mausoleum of Halicarnassus, modern-day Bodrum, if anybody's gone on holiday to Bodrum, which was built by Mausolus, King Mausolus, and it was his tomb. That's why we have mausoleums in the world. But also helped by his wife, who was not only his wife, she was his sister. So it was all a bit strange in the world of the Turkish coast around 2,300 years ago. But that was a kind of mad monument that had a bit of Greek, it had a bit of Persian, it had a bit of ancient, there was a pyramid on top of it, you know, this bonkers sort of like firework and erupting from the coast, it would have looked like, brightly coloured, covered with Amazons. So they're all very different, but all very real, as you said right at the beginning. I think people think that they're made up or sort of mythological or fantastical. These were all real places built
so
by
with
real
the
people.
Hanging Garden of Babylon, because I mean I the word sort of conjures up this extraordinary Garden of Eden falling down towards the earth, but are you working on descriptions from books, or how do you conjure that one up?
So there were eyewitnesses to it, and people write about it, and Alexander the Great was supposed to have visited it. Our challenge is that we haven't got absolutely indisputable archaeological evidence for it yet, so we are just going on descriptions, but the descriptions are very, you know, they're very precise, and there's, for example, they describe this sort of mechanical system that like was like a screw that drew water up from the river and then watered the gardens, these sloping gardens, like sort of giant, almost like kind of giant window boxes, I think they would have been. And interesting details, like they talk about using bitumen, which is basically a kind of ancient asphalt almost, to line wood and the interior of palm trees so that the water wouldn't seep through and kind of drop down on people who were walking underneath. So I'm sure actually they did exist, but it's just, you know, I can't say as a historian X marks the spot until we found the spot that X marks.
Were these all built before Christ?
So yes, they were. And the one that sort of lasted the longest was the lighthouse of Alexandria. So you also have the Colossus of Rhodes, which is this enormous statue which only stood for 50 years and then fell down because of an earthquake on either overlooking the harbour at Rhodes or on the harbour at Rhodes. But the lighthouse of Alexandria, which was built sometime around 297 BC, that lasted until the 14th century, and it was only just earthquake after earthquake that eventually made that tumble. So they're all pre-Christ. All of them like they shared artists. People used to go on these ancient travel tours to go and see them. You go on your seven wonder journey. There's a brilliant woman, you would love her, absolutely love her, called Egeria, who was in the 4th century, who was this sort of clearly feisty individual who travelled to the Holy Land by herself and to the sites. And she writes about the pyramid, the Great Pyramid in Giza. And she's the first person who says, I think this was Joseph's granaries, where Joseph stored all the wheat and grain. And then that caught on as an idea. So from her time onwards, you often have these medieval representations. They thought that the pyramid wasn't a tomb. It was somewhere where Joseph, where all that grain was stored. Amazing.
How extraordinary.
I know,
how simply wonderful. Yeah. And also how we believe something without ever kind of checking it out.
Exactly.
And or questioning it either.
Exactly. Well, she was obviously looking at them thinking, I know what they must have been. They must relate to the Bible. And she was obviously on a sort of spiritual quest as well. So wanting to see. But she's somebody I'd love. Can you imagine doing that, you know, 1600
Phenomenal.
Years ago on your own as a woman, going through all those hot spots of human history? Anyway, she wrote about her travels, so we've got the account of her journey, which is pretty awesome.
I wonder, because I think there are some wonders of the world today, if not quite as extraordinary, but in some ways the cathedrals, whether at Köln or in Germany or Winchester here are extraordinary works of architecture and space, craftsmanship and windows, and it's a real reaching towards the infinite, which is what the pyramid was doing in Egypt,
yes.
Which I do find breathtaking.
Yes.
And they're now, they were begun such a long time ago that, again, there's nothing we've done recently that I can think of which half as much mirrors what they've achieved in the past.
No.
Our ancestors achieved, rather.
No. I and you wonder what that is. Is it partly because ancient generations and generations of the past, first of all, life was really, really tough. I know that life is tough for some people now, but everybody faced death. If you're a woman, you were more likely to die in childbirth to survive it. You didn't know whether there was going to be a marauding army taking over or a new pandemic coming. So I do think there was a bit of a sense of seize the day, you know, because you don't know what's around the corner. And that sort of intensity of ambition to try to make your world more beautiful, you know, the tougher it was, the more beautiful you wanted to make it. It's really interesting, that, isn't it? That sort of pursuit of beauty. And neuroscientists now tell us that we're at our happiest and most productive either when we're going for a walk, because that's what we're supposed to do because we're nomads, and that's why we have good ideas when we go for a walk, and also when we use our hands to make things, because that's the other thing that we do as a species, is sort of make tools. So actually, although there would have been suffering and enslavement and, you know, corruption and abuse and all of those terrible things that seem to, you know, accompany the human story, I think actually when people were making those craftsmen and sometimes women would have got incredible satisfaction from fashioning a beautiful, you know, a curling smile of a goddess, you know, the size of the sofa I'm sitting on, or, you know, making a kind of lily out of glass to go on the statue of Zeus. So you sort of feel that pursuit of beauty and excellence and craftsmanship is something, it would be brilliant if that could return today or be nourished or fostered in all schools. You know, it's something that we should be encouraged to do, is to make beautiful things.
I completely agree with you. And I know that when one of my son's first schools, they had a very good pottery wheel and things like that, which he loved. It allowed them to chill.
Yes.
And it allowed them to just work with their hands. And there was a wood turning place as well.
Yes.
Which was absolutely invaluable. So I think it's very, we had very good dance classes. I'm so old that we did national dancing and things like that. But again, yes. it's movement, it's coordination.
Yes.
And it's teamwork, because you're always dancing as a team for all of those things, which is brilliant.
Exactly.
I think it's much narrower now.
Yes.
And I don't think I'd have done very well if I had to do maths A level. It's not my thing.
No.
Like you, I prefer all the languages.
No, well, exactly. Well, there's no reason as well. It's not mutually exclusive, is it? If you think of geniuses like Leonardo, people can be good at maths and good at art. You know, it's just another way of expressing ourselves. And I constantly think, if you think back to those terrible times of COVID and lockdown, and within a few days, no one knew what was going to happen. People thought everybody was going to die. Even then, with this terrible threat, and a lot of people, you know, did die, as we know, but even in those terrible times, one of the first things that we all did was sit down and start painting again, or take up embroidery, or knitting, or, you know, making, as you said, making pots. So, and that's really interesting, isn't it? At a time when there is a real existential threat to us, we make art. You know, it matters to us that much.
And when I've got a knotty problem, or my preferred way of meeting people is to go for a walk.
Yes.
Often with the dogs.
Yeah.
And just wandering around. It sorts things out. The movement's good, and the movement's good for thought too. And I always remember reading the fourth Earl of Carnarvon, who lived in Victorian times, when he had various statesmen such as Disraeli or Lord Salisbury staying, or the founding fathers of Canada or Australia, or many of the most amazing people who stayed in this house, have stayed in this house, they always used to be going out for a walk.
Yes.
A walk around the azaleas, called the American Garden, you know, a walk around the park.
Yeah.
And if the weather was awful and it was just the family, Lord and Lady Carnarvon would get up And apparently they'd walk around the dining room for half an hour.
Right.
That was their exercise. So it was just, I love these details. Yeah. I mean, they're just extraordinary, yeah. You know, perambulation. Yeah. It's great.
That's just, you see, isn't that fascinating? And I'm sure, as you said, they wrinkled out, you know, ironed out a lot of wrinkles at that time.
And they were walking together around the dining room. Yeah. And I just found that, I don't know why, that's really stuck with me.
I agree. I love, oh my goodness, I just love that image. Isn't that fantastic?
Having said that, of course, in Jane Austen, Pride and Prejudice with Mr. Darcy, you know, there was a scene in which Eliza Bennet is walking round the drawing room,
yes,
with one of her arch rivals, effectively, for the hand of Mr. Darcy, Mr. Bingham's sister or whatever, and they're walking together inside. We sit too much watching a funny box in the corner.
Yeah, we definitely. Listen, this is my new New Year's resolution. I'm going to walk once a week. Let's start. Let's not be unrealistic. I'm going to walk for half an hour around my, I don't have a dining room table, but around my around my kitchen table.
Well, you can go outside if it's not raining. Yes, but it's just, but when it's
raining. Do it inside. It's a really good idea.
It's interesting.
Really interesting. That done. Indoors walking.
Indoors walking. Should we phone each other on a video what we're doing?
Definitely.
Looking for our bright ideas.
Yes,
for our
definitely.
Mad purpose, which is great. And I obviously have loved your book on Istanbul. Oh. Which was Byzantium, Constantinople, so many names, but the city which is at the crossroads of so much of civilization. But what heartened me was you said it took sort of 10 years of research and writing to pull together, because I sort of panicked that I've got to do another book within a set time.
Yes.
And what is rather wonderful is hearing from another historical author, far more senior than myself, that how long it does actually take.
Yeah, and I think, you know what, it's really interesting. I think you very good to stick to your guns on that, because as you say, there are publishers and other authors who'll say, oh, it could take 2 years, you know, do it in 2 years. But how can you? You know, you're skimming the surface and these are other people's stories that you're telling. So you ought to give them at least the respect of enough time to research those stories properly. And I also think it's funny, isn't it? There's always this sort of Aggie, oh, you know, you've got to get it out there, get it out into the market. If it's a good book, it will have its own time, you know, and there will always be an audience for a book that has been properly researched. So it doesn't matter whether it's 4 years after, you know, people would want it ideally. So go for it. Take your time. Maybe you should write it in the bath as well as read other books. But I think you're right. You've got to, because you're the same as me. That I never want to finish. You know, I always want to turn over another leaf and sort of look underneath.
I think I could have done something better. And yeah. I found the letters I meant to find?
Yeah, exactly.
And then you suddenly, sometimes I find things so by chance that I find it quite frightening, because I did find it so much by chance.
Yes.
And if I designed a way of looking for it, I'd never have found it. So it's some of those chance-like happenings which become such an integral part of your writing.
Yes.
That I sort of end up panicking.
Yes.
That there may have been some other chances.
I know.
That I have missed.
Poor, so our poor publishers. We must drive them mad.
I don't know.
No, I want to add another one. Oh, I know. But what's your next book? Do you know?
Well, I'm turning it over in my head still, actually. I haven't completely found it. I think it's going to be more about living in a castle. The day-to-day hilarity.
Yes.
Or sadness, or, you know, this, the day-to-day lives.
Yes.
Which I think might be of interest to people, because it's still an extraordinary place to live.
Yes.
And, again, the walls have history. But books have history. Books are a treasure. They were written by somebody, about somebody.
Yeah.
The black and white words on a page, which you could read. You enter it in with your imagination.
Yeah.
You interpret and analyse it. They are treasures.
Yeah.
So that is... I love books. But for my own next little book, I was thinking of just telling some of the stories behind the scenes here.
Great.
Which I thought might be quite fun.
Really good fun. I'm really interested to see what parallels those have in the sort of earlier history of the place, and, you know, really interesting.
Yes, I think it's a reinventing a castle.
Yeah.
It's reinventing a home.
Yeah.
is what my thoughts were.
Yeah, fantastic. So oh, how exciting. Well, yes. I'll absolutely read it. Well, as soon as you've written it, send me over the...
the proof. You say, oh, it's not like that, is it? But I just thought reinvention, and it's a fresh start to a new year, and we are trying to reinvent ourselves. We are restless. We try to manage change and it panics us, and yet we have to change. But do we have to change?
Yes. Again, neuroscientists tell us that we crave disruption as a species. Our brains want to be disrupted.
I don't think I crave disruption. I really don't. Mm. I find that my brain can fire off with different ideas, but I crave anchor and a sense of reassurance.
Yeah.
Curiously enough, one of my favourite poets before I met with my husband was a man called George Herbert, 17th century poet, and he wrote a cycle of poems called The Temple. And one of them, one of my sisters read at our wedding, Love, which begins, Love, baby, welcome, yet my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. And it moves through the stanzas to the fact at the end, so I did sit and eat, which is, again, sitting down together. But the other poem, which I often turn around in my mind, is called The Pulley. And it starts, when God at first made man, having a glass of blessing standing by, let us, said he, pour on him all we can. So beauty, truth, courage, love, they all made their way. And this, again, George Herbert moves through the poem, neither of them are long poems, to say that at the end, alone of all his gifts, rest in the bottom lay, so that if goodness does not toss us to God's breast, then weariness may toss us to his breast. Yeah. So it's that restlessness which George Herbert was always looking for in his life.
Yes.
His expectations of being a successful courtier, a successful man around the king and his court. And none of that came to pass, and he had to accept being the rector of a country parish and living every day as it was, and reconciling his acceptance and love of God rather than his ambitious love of God. It's an extraordinary life, an extraordinary man.
Yes, how beautiful. Mm. I know the poet, but I don't know that poem, Love, so I must read that.
Love and The Pulley, two really useful poems, which through some of the challenging times of my life, I sort of recite to myself as I go for a walk.
Yeah.
I love poetry.
Yes.
And I quite enjoy reading. I read a lot of different poetry.
Yes.
There's so many things I'd love to share. I mean, there's so many things here to... There's so many treasures in the library.
Oh, we'll have... Maybe we should come and have a poetry day one day. We can go for a walk, we can make a pot, and then we can read some poetry.
We can ask it, see if anybody else wants to join us.
Yes. Perfect. Perfect.
Silence. See if we get any reaction.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bethany, so much for joining me here today. It is, as ever, a joy, and we clearly have new projects in our lives together.
We do. Mm. We do. Such a total delight. So lovely to talk to you, and peace and love to the world this year.
Yes, that would be lovely, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it?
Hopeful. Why not join me to enjoy a plethora of fascinating topics, guests, and friends from the world of Highclere Castle, the real Downton Abbey. Whether you love movies or care about the planet, wish to discover the best gardening or cooking tips, hear about innovation, music, or the history of flight, I hope you will thoroughly enjoy the library we have created on my podcast page at ladycanavan.com.